The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. I'm Jeet here of The Nation magazine, which is the sponsor of this podcast. The podcast is widely available on all platforms and some radio stations. So this podcast, because we deal with politics, things have been very bleak for a long time now, but occasionally there is some good news, and I would be amiss if I didn't mention it. We actually are seeing some progress on the Democratic Party side in terms of figuring out how to combat Trump. And I think this can be seen both in the sort of campaign that Zoran Mamdani is running to be mayor of New York, and also some of the scandals that are now engulfing the Trump administration relating to Jeffrey Epstein. To talk about both matters, I'm very happy to have on a returning guest, Greg Sargent, who's a staff writer for The New Republic, where he also does a podcast, The Daily Blast. And Greg is always a very acute and observant commentator on American politics. And I was especially taken by a column he just did about Mamdani, looking at his success in terms of messaging, which I think has broader political lessons. So first of all, Greg, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so let's talk about this column that you wrote, because I think that it's a different take. I think there's been a lot written about Mamdani, but a lot of it rehearses sort of familiar ground, either in terms of his politics or the controversies around him. But I actually thought that you had fresh observations in terms of how he was able to like win a really unexpected victory in the Democratic primary, and now seems to be polling actually quite well.
Yeah, well, so what I did was I got very curious about why his videos were doing so well. And we should note that his videos are really unpaid, which is to say these are not ads. These are just social media videos that the Mamdani campaign makes, often in settings like on sidewalks or in coffee shops or similar. And very similar to how many average people make videos. He does them at a high level of professionalism. He has a very good team, but he's getting extraordinary reach with these videos. So I talked to his video people at some length and in some depth about what they're doing, and the answers were very interesting. I should say right off the bat that they're getting really surprising penetration on Instagram, which is really an innovation for a campaign, I think, at least in certain ways. So here's a good example. Mamdani recently released a video announcing that he was taking a vacation in his childhood home of Uganda. And he did some really weird stuff on there, at least striking stuff, where he mocked right-wing trolls for telling him to go back to Africa. He joked that his return there showed that he's listening to critics telling him to go back to Africa. And he even offered the New York Post, the Murdoch tabloid in New York, suggestions for headlines that were mocking of his trip to Africa, right? So like, for instance, he proposed MIA, Mamdani in Africa, and said, you know, Insalab, please put them on your front pages, which is a pretty remarkable thing to do, to tweak the right. Got 4.5 million views on Instagram, 56% among people who weren't following Mamdani on the messaging site. So he's getting amazing penetration.
Yeah, yeah. And one should mention, like, Instagram, you know, is a very popular social media site, but I think is like mainly used for personal things. I mean, I know people use it to, you know, show pictures of their kids or show pictures of their meal or new dresses and suits that they bought. It is not normally where like political messaging spreads.
Exactly right.
So I think that the fact that he's able to like have such success there, to my mind, would maybe indicate that he's reaching people that aren't normally following politics.
I think that's exactly it. And I should note that his campaign takes pride in this, that they were actually able to shift in their direction areas of the city that went towards Trump. Now, we all know the story there. Donald Trump made these alarming for Democrats and liberals, inroads with non-white working class people, including some immigrant communities. That was very prevalent in New York City. Obviously, he didn't win New York City, but he made these inroads among these constituencies that are normally thought of as Democratic. And so the Mamdani campaign was able to pull some of those people back in some big numbers. And those are exactly the types of people we're talking about, right? They're low information voters. They're not paying close attention to politics. They're working class. Many of them are immigrants. And he's able to get to them with political messaging that seems very personal. That's sort of the extraordinary thing about what he's doing. I want to read a quote from a tech writer named Mike Masnick, who really, I thought, captured the point that you just made a few minutes ago. He said, quote, "People spend a lot of time on short form video apps looking to be entertained by real people. Mamdani's been able to produce political content that meets that need." There you have it. People go to the Instagram to hang out and watch funny social media videos of cats, right? And people cooking. And so there you get this guy Mamdani talking about traffic on 34th Street and and permits for vendors and really stuff that you wouldn't think goes viral, and he makes it go viral.
Yeah, no, I think that's a point really worth considering, especially about the sort of like low information voters. And I think that one thing that has repeatedly taken Democrats by surprise is Donald Trump's ability to reach those voters. But yes. I mean, I think if one steps back a little bit, you know, like Donald Trump's celebrity came from the show The Apprentice, which had like a kind of wide reach and among people who don't like watch CNN, right? Who don't like follow the news obsessively or read the New York Times. And then Donald Trump also, like throughout his political career, has kind of pursued media celebrity in sort of like tabloid form, always wanting to be in the New York Post, but and even the National Enquirer, but also like, you know, going on professional wrestling, where he was actually a fixture for many years. So Donald Trump, prior to his official political career, had actually created a public persona that had a very wide reach. And he had an identity with voters who, again, are not reading the New York Times, right? And are not like looking at political platforms, but have seen this guy many times, have some sort of sense of his personality, and came to view him as someone that many of them felt that they liked or could trust. So, I mean, I think the political dilemma of this kind of like media age, very fragmented media age, is how do you reach those people? And not to replicate Donald Trump's strategy, which I think is perhaps a one-off and can't be, one certainly hasn't seen any other Republican being able to do what Trump has done. But I think that Mamdani has shown that there are like other ways of reaching those voters.
Yes, I think the key point you're making is about the culture, right? So Donald Trump's innovation as a politician was the extraordinary penetration into the culture that he gets. And this is a real problem for Democrats, precisely because that penetration gets to those types of voters we're talking about. We're sort of in the middle of this massive debate among Democrats right now about how to do that. Much of the debate kind of turns on how do we use paid digital spots and non-traditional ways, or creating a Joe Rogan of the left, to use that silly cliche, right? To get that penetration that Donald Trump has gotten. I think Democrats recognize that whatever it is that Trump did, which is sort of hard to pin down, that's something Democrats have to be able to do. And Mamdani's campaign is very acutely aware of that as the challenge. And if you watch the videos, you can see that they're thinking hard about how to turn him into a more ubiquitous figure in the culture. One advisor on the Mamdani campaign that I spoke to, Andrew Epstein, the campaign's creative director, said, if you are, quote, on your phone, you are going to see Zohran. That's the goal. And that's what Trump does, right? He's everywhere at all times. And Democrats are not everywhere at all times. They're often not anywhere. And so it's just interesting to me how Zohran is trying to crack that code.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, it's actually interesting because, I mean, normally prior to maybe the last year or two, I would have said the problem with Democrats is that they're going on Meet the Press and CNN and not like looking at things like podcast or, you know, new media the way Trump was. But like, actually, I think even the last year, like it's become even worse than that because they're not even going on Meet the Press. They don't seem to be like even doing like regular media as much as they used to.
Yeah, that's
like,
true.
They're often missing in action. But in any case, I think some of the sort of like you mentioned the aesthetic aspect. I think it's worth pointing out, and I'll link to your piece, which I would highly recommend, both Greg's analysis, and then also you include embedded in your piece some of these videos. And I think it's worth paying attention to the aesthetic of both like the sort of like the fast cut. They often show, you know, Mamdani, who's a, you know, attractive young guy, walking the streets. And they do have that kind of like TikTok aesthetic.
Yes.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Like how the aesthetic is adapted to the age that we're in?
Sure. The aesthetic, it's interesting that you call it a TikTok aesthetic because that is very clearly what they're going for. And I should say that the numbers on TikTok, in addition to Instagram, are quite good too. He's on over 1 million views and at least 10 videos. And Masnik, the tech writer I referenced earlier, told me that the key metric here is consistency. And so if this is a guy who can consistently get 1 million views or more on TikTok with messaging, again, about government and politics, that's the essence of this that's so interesting. At one point, he talks about 4 city council bills that would affect vending licenses. And yet he just sort of slips it in this way that you don't really realize you're being taught because of the aesthetic. It's wrapped in this kind of street, you know, walking the streets, talking to vendors, talking to people. There are even parts where he says hi to people. But none of it feels forced. That's the thing about it that I think is hard to duplicate. Anyone can kind of say, well, just go out and do one of these. But to make them actually work and make them authentic, that's the key thing. And I was very struck, by the way, by the constant use of food in these videos. Now, mm-hmm. I lived in New York for a very long time. I grew up there. And I actually used to, if I could get personal for a second, I had a thing I used to do with an old friend where we would walk through the city and just eat, right? Mm-hmm. Long walks. And I'm talking, when I say long, I mean like really long, like maybe at one point we went up to as high as 5 miles through the city, 6-7 miles. And it's an enormous pleasure to be able to stroll from one ethnic neighborhood to the next and sample different food as you're walking. It's like the city's bounty, you know, like if you live in New York, you have this amazing thing at your fingertips at all times. And I think there's a celebratory tone to what Zohran's doing when he walks the streets. And there's a video in Little Haiti he shoots where he's eating different things at different places while walking on the streets. That's a striking aesthetic that is really celebratory of New York's essence, I think, in a way that a lot of Democrats should pay attention to.
Yeah, no, I mean, you bring up a couple of points there that I want to unpack a little bit. One of which is, I think one has to keep in mind the substance of the stuff that he's talking about, which I think is not unrelated to the popularity. It's not just an aesthetic matter. And a lot of these are the sort of Instagram TikTok aesthetic is like you talk about ordinary things that other people can relate to, like food or clothing or, yes, you know, like walking the neighborhood. But he ties that in with, you know, substantive issues because they are tied in. Like, you know, people do in part of the ordinary conversation complain about traffic, you know, they complain about getting around the city. And so, you know, like if he brings that up and then uses it to talk about bus lanes, then it becomes relevant. And as you said, one of the pleasures of a great city like New York is the street food. And then one of his videos is halal inflation, talking about the regulations that make buying halal chicken more expensive than it should be. So I think it's a very clever sort of mixture of the everyday vernacular topics that thrive on social media, but always linking them up with those substantive policy things and showing that there is an appetite for thinking about those issues if you address them in the right way.
Yeah, 100%.
Not to make a pun.
Yeah, 100%. And the substance is the aesthetic. I think you really touched on something very key there. His advisors talking to me were really emphatic about that point, that it isn't just the aesthetic. It isn't just the person that they're putting front and center, although it's absolutely central that they're putting this person out there in the same way TikTok does, right? And Instagram does. Just to go back to what we discussed before, places like Instagram and TikTok are where you go to hang out with people, right? Mm-hmm. You go there to watch people do cool stuff and to get to know people who you think are cool. And so he's basically that guy, but he's a politician. And so I thought the halal inflation one that you cited was, and that, by the way, I should note, that was probably one of their biggest successes. And it just starts with him inside of a halal vending truck talking to the guy about like what it's like to sell this stuff to people on the streets. And I mean, if you live in New York, you encounter people like that every single day. And so you're encountering him again in this video. And then all of a sudden, he's just telling you, by the way, the reason your plate of food at this cart is $10 instead of $8 is because there are these government bottlenecks that are screwing things up. And so he's suddenly talking almost like, I don't know, an abundance agenda person, right? Saying, just basically saying, you know, by the way, all this stuff that you're experiencing in your everyday life really is just downstream of bad governing decisions. And so it's remarkable stuff.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And to hit on another point that you had made, which I want to unpack a little bit, is this element of sort of like enjoyment, which I think is very key. And it's, again, both an aesthetic message, but it's also a kind of political message. And I think one way to think about this is that Donald Trump and the right offer a very dark vision of like urban America, you know, like American carnage. Crime is out of control, you know, these democratic run cities. And I think one of the things that you get from Mamdani's videos is that this is someone who enjoys being a New Yorker, enjoys, you know, the things that the city has to offer and recognizes that, you know, there's a reason why so many people live in New York, right? Like, you know, the restaurant is not popular. It's too crowded. And so I think this politics of joy or this politics of enjoyment is a very important part of the political message.
Yeah, and I should point out that there's a subtext to what you're saying there about the dark MAGA messaging about urban centers. MAGA messaging is fun for MAGA. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like MAGA people,
they love it.
They thrill to it. Like, so if Trump is out there calling New York a sewer pit and calling New Yorkers rats, it's like their idea of entertainment.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And so it's probably worth, you know, underscoring that Zohran is counter-programming that, right? He's saying it's cool to live in a diverse world city that has people from all over the world that are doing all kinds of really interesting things, and we can make it even more awesome. That's the message.
Yeah, no. I think that's absolutely right. And I think in your piece, you also bring in another aspect of this message, which is the enjoyment or appreciation of the diversity of the city. And that's also sort of countering the kind of dark MAGA message, which does have a libidinal pleasure in the sort of thrill of like picking on groups that you don't like.
Yes.
But in Mamdani's case, offering a counter message that that's great to live in the city with so many different cultures. And really a response to kind of like the sort of zero-sum racial politics that Trump has really revived in such a successful way, like a different way of thinking about the story of immigration in America.
You know, I hadn't thought of this until you just said all that. But if you think about that one video, right, the one with the New York Post where he talks about his trip to Uganda, he actually puts on the screen right-wing trolling attacks on him, right? And so he's sort of frontally presenting the thing you're talking about, which is that libidinal pleasure on the right of attacking groups like the ones that Mamdani belongs to, right? And at the same time, he's also sort of doing the social media thing of polarizing stuff, right? He's essentially saying, I'm in their heads. Now, MAGA loves the idea that Trump is in your head and my head, right? This is something you see constantly on social media. Like if you say something negative about Trump, you'll get a million LOLs. He's totally living rent-free in your head, blah, 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 right? And so there's Mamdani is kind of taking that and repurposing it for his own ends, isn't he? If you really think about it, he's doing the social media thing of saying, check it out, we're doing so well, we're getting in their heads.
Absolutely. And I do actually think that some of the sort of, you know, media overkill, which came like not just from the New York Post and Fox News, but to be honest, the New York Times, and the Atlantic magazine, I think that itself also rebounded to Mamdani's advantage because he was able to use this to say like, oh, look, I've gotten, you know, like inside their heads, they're worried about me. And for a politician, that can be actually a very strong sort of message.
It can, although I think probably, and I'm reasonably sure his people are aware of that as they pivot into the general election. Like that was a summer video, right?
As
they pivot into the general, I think they're going to tone that kind of thing down, is my guess, because they really do have to broaden his appeal to some of these other older New York constituencies, like working class blacks and Upper West Side and Upper East Side Jews and And I guess even to some degree, outer borough whites, to the degree that I don't know how many outer borough whites are left in New York. I've lost touch with the city in many ways, but
yeah,
it's still, you know, there's still plenty, and he's going to have to win some of them. A lot depends on what the field shakes out as, but I do think he'll probably tone down the types of appeals that, you know, deliberately provoke.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you know, I mean, and again, I think the Trump analogy is perhaps useful. Like, there's a kind of primary message that you use to get up your base in the primary, and then maybe tone down some of that stuff in the general election. I mean, having said that, I should also mention, like, I think, like, the most recent polls I've sort of seen do indicate that, like, you know, now that he is the Democratic nominee, a lot of groups that hadn't been with him in the primaries are sort of coming on board. Like,
yes.
There's a sort of, you know, rallying around the effective leader. So I think that itself is worth thinking about. But can we talk about, like, how this might play out in the sort of, like, broader Democratic Party? You know, obviously, this is an exceptionally talented politician, and I think he also has the advantage of sort of, like, youth and of having a team that is more sort of digitally native and has adapted. But, like, how confident are you that the party can, like, learn lessons from this that can be more broadly applied?
So, yeah, I mean, this guy is tremendously talented. He's clearly very charismatic. But win or lose, even if he loses, I think at the end that there will be lessons that Democrats can take from this campaign, from the digital approach especially. Now, look, obviously, certain things that Mamdani is saying might not play in certain districts and certain states in the same way that they play in New York. I don't think that's a secret. Like, a lot of these swing district Democrats win their races by a point, and they have to be pretty moderate in many ways. But that doesn't mean you can't take this sort of approach that he's adopting and use it. It could, as far as I can tell, I don't see why you couldn't use a similar approach to deliver all sorts of messaging. The key, the essential ingredient is actual authenticity, right? We constantly talk about the need for Democrats to be more authentic and so forth, and often they just don't seem to heed that advice. But the key seems to me to be that he's figured out that if you just talk authentically about what you actually believe, then you can reach people. And I'm not sure why Democrats, well, centrist Democrats, moderate Democrats can't do that effectively with their own ideas. What do you think? It seems like it's a lesson that many Democrats could repurpose.
Yeah, I do think that the value of, like, being more forthright and not seeming like, you know, like you're taking messages that have been, like, tested through pollsters is a good one. I mean, I think even for, like, centrist Democrats, I mean, like, that term, like, to my mind, has some sort of ambiguity. I do think that, like, even they, or I think especially they, like, might need to lean into the affordability issues that Mamdani did.
Yeah, right.
So it's not just a matter of, you know, the media techniques, which are well worth borrowing, but I think also the emphasis on actual concrete daily life stuff. And I think that, yeah, I think certainly centrist Democrats can be talking, you know, especially since Trump has made Medicare and Social Security live issues. If they put that as the foreground of what they're concerned with, then yeah, I do think that this can be duplicated.
It sure seems that way. And I think if they were to get serious about that, you'd essentially take the general approach. And I think you articulated this really well earlier, which is that the starting point is to talk about something that everyday ordinary people experience all the time. That's the connection point. That's the initial spark.
Yeah.
So when he talks about traffic on 34th Street, for instance, he's just talking to people about something they experience every day and don't like. Same with prices at a halal truck.
Yeah.
And so I don't see why a centrist or moderate Democrat couldn't do that and then just talk authentically about what they actually think about the reasons people are going through what they're going through. And I think.
I think it's worth talking about thinking this through. Like, I mean, I think one thing that we're likely to see is rise in like the price of coffee because of these tariffs on Brazil, which is like, you know, the major supplier of American coffee. And like, so I do think a centrist Democrat, you know, who might not share my politics, but can certainly do commercial where you're going to a Dunkin' Donut and say like, hey, why is the coffee so expensive now? And say like, you know, like I'm all for, you know, like an America First trade policy, but like, you know, like I, like it doesn't, why is it making coffee more expensive rather than creating jobs? You know, like I think that sort of messaging has to be the key. I mean, it's something you and I have gone back and forth about, but like, I think that some of the more broader centrist messaging that's sort of focused on defending democracy ran the risk of being too abstract. And connecting with real issues, but not connecting them with things that people could actually see in their daily lives. But I certainly think that a video about like the rising price of coffee, a video about, you know, somebody who's dependent on Medicare and can't get it now.
Why was the line so long? Why did you have to wait so long?
Yeah, well, why can't my grandma call up Social Security
exactly
and get like a straight answer? Like,
yeah, know? I love that. You could easily see like, you know, my grandmother spent 45 minutes on the phone with Social Security the other day, and she didn't get a satisfactory answer, and she's trying to get her benefits check. Guess why that's happening? That guy Elon Musk, right? Blah 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 blah. How we fix it. We can easily fix it, but lunatics are in charge. Ideologues are in charge who don't want the government to work for you.
Absolutely. So I mean, I think like there's a ways in which centrists can do this message, but I think it also involves their retooling or rethinking the way they approach these issues. But I mean, I think they can do it within their own political framework and within, you know, the districts that they're running for. But it requires some actual thought in terms of like how does this actually relate to like lived experience, which I think is the key to this type of media.
And also, I think it's essential that you underscore the importance of affordability to Mamdani's message. Again, substance being a really critical part of this. That's, you'd think, something that a lot of centrist and moderate Democrats would rally around and really be willing to learn from. How often do we hear the popularists, as we call them, tell us that everything has to be brought back to the kitchen table? Well, you know, I don't know if it's exactly the kitchen table, the price of your street food since you're eating outside, but it's the same. That impulse, I would think, would be something that they would cheer.
One would hope so that, you know, like, especially since he both won the primary and is looking pretty good for the general election, they should think about the lessons that all this offers. I want to talk about this issue of how you reach voters who aren't plugged into politics and bring in like another thing that's in the news, which you've also written about, which is the Jeffrey Epstein case. And I've like long felt this going back to when Epstein was first rearrested, that Democrats kind of made a mistake in not like, you know, paying attention to this case and even like trying to downplay it and, you know, like writing off a lot of this stuff as conspiracy theories, which I have to say, there are a lot of like really crazy conspiracy theories about this. But I do actually think they also have always been legitimate questions about the Epstein case. And I think more importantly, if we're just thinking about the broader politics, the Epstein case, for, you know, like a variety of, I think, fairly obvious reasons, reaches people that do not otherwise pay attention to politics. And I think that this was the aspect that the right picked up on, that, you know, like you could mention Jeffrey Epstein's name on something like Joe Rogan or some sort of podcast, and you would get people's, their ears would prick up. They would like, you know, want to hear more about this. And I do actually think that Trump himself was never like that much into emphasizing Epstein. He did it occasionally. I think for good reasons he wasn't into it, but the people around him, his family members and like all the people like Steve Bannon certainly like picked up on it. And now I feel like it's boomeranging on them in a big way. And maybe Democrats can rethink, you know, the fact that, hey, this is like a topic that allows you to reach voters that you cannot otherwise talk to.
Well, look, anything that involves children is going to reach a lot of people as well, and especially bad things happening to children, as this scandal obviously involves horribly.
Yeah.
So, yes, I think the right really, and I, as much as I hate to admit it, the QAnon stuff and the really out there, the cracked MAGA conspiracies, and as crazy as they are, on some level, they're premised on an understanding of what gets people going.
Yeah.
Right. And I hadn't thought of the Epstein thing as something to reach these voters who are in these different cultural spaces, but that's a great point. It absolutely gets this kind of penetration that a lot of other issues, including kitchen table ones, maybe don't get. It's emotional. It's easy to understand. Mm-hmm. It's got clear villains, which is a very critical piece of this. And look, some Democrats are actually doing a pretty good job with this. I like what Senator Ron Wyden has been doing. He, as the ranking Democrat on the Finance Committee, I should just bring this up. I wrote a piece about this at TNR.com. People can check out. But his staff was actually at the Treasury Department viewing what are called these suspicious activity reports. And this is a little technical, but I'm telling you, it's worth it, people, because it's really interesting. So banks are required to file these suspicious activity reports if they see financial transactions that are dubious. And they flagged a lot of Epstein transactions.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Right. Yes. And so on file with the Treasury Department is apparently like, you know, thousands and thousands of questionable financial transactions by Jeffrey Epstein, some involving the pedophile ring. And these are, financial transactions that go out to other people, money coming into Epstein. And so Wyden has called on DOJ to investigate these transactions on file with Treasury and for Treasury to release them to Congress mainly, and I guess the public, although I'm not sure how that would work. And there's a good example of a Democrat kind of taking an issue that people intuitively understand, right? Global elites shoveling money to each other for nefarious purposes and, packaging it as a Trump cover-up.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that with the Epstein case is obviously the sort of sensationalist aspect, which gets people's attention. And then there's a sort of QAnon spin on this, which is, we can I think, rightly dismiss as unhinged. But I think that the appeal of the QAnon stuff is that it is a narrative that tries to make sense out of things that don't otherwise make sense, and which the official narratives aren't willing to deal with. There's a lot of very legitimate questions, and I think Ron Wyden has the exact right approach, which is look at the money.
Yeah.
So in the Epstein case, there's one obvious question which has never been satisfactorily answered despite all the great journalism that's been done, is how did this guy who was like a college dropout and math teacher, become like hugely wealthy and like totally integrated into the American economic elite? We don't actually know how that happened. And that's actually maybe worth knowing. The other aspect is why so many very wealthy people were willing to make very bizarre financial arrangements with him of giving him power of attorney over hundreds of millions of dollars. That is a very strange thing. And I think well worth public inquiry, as well as, I think still unsettled issue of why he was able to get a sweetheart deal from someone who became the head of the Department of Labor under Donald Trump. So, there's so many issues that I think are a legitimate public concern. And I think Wyden's approach, which is kind of like a forensic approach of using the investigatory power of the state, is a good one. Because, again, it's a way in which, like Mamdani, you're taking something that's of wide public interest, but actually showing that there's a government solutions or government approaches that can address this.
And by the way, what you said there kind of triggered a thought for me, which is that people intuitively understand the idea of follow the money.
Yeah.
And follow the money is deeply embedded in the culture because of the scandals that have penetrated and so forth. And people like Forensic Files. I don't know if you've ever watched Forensic Files.
True crime.
Yeah, true crime. People like that. They like forensic investigations, and they like following the money, and they like detective work. And And there are ways to slot this whole story into those molds that will get that kind of cultural penetration that eludes Democrats a lot of the time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking more broadly. Like, I do actually think, like, if we want to think about, like, you know, like, what is the sort of scandal and what are the questions to be answered, I think Ron Wyden's approach really brings out the fact that, like, the proper approach is not like the not Donald Trump, like, you know, the DOJ will, like, you know, selectively release whatever files or, you know, have conversations with Ghislaine Maxwell. I mean, this is actually a responsibility of Congress, that there is, like, you know, like, these all these outstanding questions that the public wants to know. Congress has investigatory power. If the Democrats take back the Congress and the Senate, and they can run on, like, saying, like, we will actually investigate this stuff, they could actually call up, like, all the bankers, all the people that have had dealings with Epstein, and, like, you know, like, make this, like, an actual way of showing that this is the power that the state actually has.
I love that.
To address the legitimate concerns of people.
I think that's a great idea. And I've sort of hinted at that in some of these pieces. What someone like Ron Wyden is doing there is kind of a roadmap. Well, he actually described it as a roadmap himself. He said, if Pam Bondi wants to investigate the Epstein files in a serious way, just walk over to the Treasury Department and look at these suspicious activity reports and look at Epstein's transactions. Then he literally, like, he wrote a letter to Pam Bondi laying out exactly what she should look for, almost like breadcrumbs, you know?
Yeah.
And 100%, that I think is an important point that you make there, which is that Democrats can actually demonstrate what it would mean to vote for them in the context of a story that everybody's paying attention to. You know, you vote for us, here's what we'll do to get to the bottom of this horror, and we will use our power to do that, whereas Republicans are using their power to cover it up for Trump. This is simple stuff and powerful stuff.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So on that note, I want to thank Greg for this conversation, which I thought was both very productive and I think perhaps more hopeful than a lot of political conversations have been, at least in terms of, like, you know, like, thinking productively about a way out of this, the various messes that we're all in. And I will link in the show notes, people will be able to find both Greg's article about Bamdani and also about these Jeffrey Epstein investigations. So thanks, Greg.
Thanks for having me on. It was a blast, man.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.